School of the Master, Lecture 9. Do I dare to think absolute? School of the Master, Lecture Series 1 through 14. Lecture 9. Do I dare to think absolute? What is it to think absolute? Well, so many of us get excited about thinking absolute, because we think how wonderful that would be. How wonderful it would be to be in the allness and the isness and the absoluteness, you know. And we have trouble getting along in the relative. But do I dare to think absolute? And the answer is yes, I do dare to think absolute. But when I think about absolute, I think about that which is unchanging, that which is forever the same, that which is an ideal, that which we believe and we listen to and we know and we hear about. But it's not too exciting, because it's something that none of us have ever experienced, nor will we ever experience, because it is an absolute concept. It's not a human concept. In the human world, we're always in the relative. We're always going to think relative ideas and relative concepts and relative attitudes. Now, I'm going to say, in absolute, in the allness, in whatever, everything exists. Everything is there. Every possible thing that we could ever imagine or dream is already complete in absolute. But absolute has no regard for all that is in it. It's like a king who has a large treasure, and in his treasure house he has gold and rubies and jewels and money and everything, and it makes no difference to him, because what he does with his everyday life is to deal with the people, is to deal with his family, is to deal with things that amuse him and delight him. And this is what we do. We deal with things that amuse us and delight us on the relative level. And this is what we want to do, because we think this is the most exciting thing in the world. Can we even begin to consider thinking absolute? Well, we just did consider it. We just did say that everything exists in absolute, in the allness and the isness. Everything exists there. Every idea, every possibility that we think for our relative world exists in absolute. Every concept we could ever have for ourselves exists in the absolute. We think of a car, and we think of it as its design is today. Well, think of the cars as its design was in the 1900s, in the 1930s, in the 1910s. What type of cars did they have then? Think of the car that they had back in the chariot days of the of the pharaohs. What did they have? What kind of car did they have? They had a chariot. They had two wheels, two wooden wheels that were going to haul them around. And these are two very nice wooden wheels that did everything for them and were very nice to use, but that's all they knew. Now, do you think the Pharaoh ever thought how nice it would be to have hydraulics in the wheels so that they would not bump, 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 bump on every single bump you went over, and that the chariot drivers were not driving crazy, they were driving to miss the bumps, to miss the holes, and they had to make sure they did, because if they hit a hole head-on and pretty heavy, they could break their axle. And if they broke their axle, they were out of the chariot activity. So this is something that has been thought about through the years. People thought, well, how can we make a stronger axle? How can we make an axle that does not take the full shock of the bumps that it hits? How do we make cars that do that? Well, now, isn't it interesting that today a major tire company, and probably several of them, are designing tires that are smaller and smaller and smaller. They're getting to be just 2 inches thick and no air in them. No air in the tire. The pneumatics will happen with the devices that are above the shaft of the tire, above the wheel, above the axle, and it'll just make you float, because that's where the floating is anyhow. The floating is not in the tire. The floating is not in the tire as it hits the road, because if the tires are maintained at the right level of pressure that they should have, you're going to feel all the bumps if you don't have a shock absorber. So shock absorbers are becoming something quite beautiful and quite wonderful. Now, they're now thinking of having airless tires, tires that will never need to be filled, that will never need to be changed, tires that will not wear out because they have a new substance, and the substance they make the tires out of are substances that will not wear out as they roll on the ground and as they roll along doing things. They just won't wear out. Now, why won't they wear out? Why is it that they're thinking of these things now? Did those thoughts always exist? Did those possibilities always exist? Did those possibilities of having airless tires and shock absorbers that maintain easy balance? Oh, they've thought of that many times. But you see, each little improvement that they're making is going to make more and more cost. But people are willing to spend more and more for them. There are some cars that are now in the $50,000, $100,000, $200,000. There are even million-dollar cars. Well, my goodness, have you ever investigated a million-dollar car to see what possibilities it has that make it so valuable? And no, you haven't. And are you going to look? No, you aren't. Because it doesn't interest you. It is something that will not be in your checkbook. It will not be in your garage in the near future. And the reason it won't be in your garage in the near future, because you don't need it that much. People who are on the road continuously, people who are salespeople, for instance, going from different clients to different clients, people who are delivering things, and trucking lines. Can you imagine trucking lines that no longer would need to have air in their tires? And they would have shock absorbers which would absorb all the shock. What would happen to their axles? What would happen to the truck's substance, the box of the truck and everything else like that? They would be like a cradle. The material in it would be cradled. It wouldn't be so bumpy and so rough as it has been in over the years. But you see, always there's that improvement. Now, where does that improvement come from? Does that improvement come from the idea that this is something that exists that we can have right now? No. The idea does not exist right now and does not come from something that exists right now. The idea, it comes from something that's beyond that. We have the ability to think beyond all the present wonderful things that are being done to the cars, because we don't think of what's being done. We think of things beyond what's being done. We think far beyond anything that is being considered, because our mind has so many facets to it of thinking of our brain, has so many facets to it of thinking of ideas that are so beyond anything that has ever been thought about or ever been created. Now, who's going to do this creation? Well, as we have been finding out, and listening to Eureka, and as we have been finding out, people of younger and younger age are doing these things. Now, why are they doing these things? Why are people of so young an age doing these things? People of so young an age are doing these things because they don't know it can't be done. They have these strange and outlandish and outrageous and outstanding ideas that come to their consciousness, and they just think, okay, how should we go about bringing it out? How should we go about making it? Who ever thought of a Google? Who ever thought of Wikip? Wikipedia. Whoever thought of a universal dictionary that everyone could contribute to and everyone could add to the genius of it, and it was checked over by others so that the genius that was added was always, like with the National Geographic and Reader's Digest, the articles that go in there are read and reread and read and reread, and then they're compared to the facts, and then they're made sure that the information that they have in there is precisely correct, and that the information that they're quoting from other people has been permitted to be quoted. And they have to go through millions, not millions, but hundreds of checkpoints. And so when you start something as silly as Facebook, it's just a social organization where people are getting together and talking to one another and sharing. Now people are trying to make it more commercial. They're trying to make it more professional. They're trying to make it more complex. And they'll kill it. And a new one will start up that'll go back to the simplicity. Because the simplicity is what they want. Now, Twitter is reaching out beyond its limits to all these things. And who created these things? Who created, what was the age of the young people that created these things? They were in school or just out of school, or they decided to quit school and create their ideas that came to them because they were inspired. And they were in their 18s and 20s and 30s. They're just young people. Now, how can they do that? Where do those ideas come from? Do those ideas come out of all of their research that they've done in books? You can be sure not. You can be sure the idea came out of their imagination. Just like Einstein says, imagination is the greatest tool to all science and all mathematics and all physics and all science. And truly it is, because whatever the mind of man can conceive and believe, he can achieve because he doesn't think it's impossible. Mm-hmm. He already thinks, hey, there's a way. Now, let's start to see. And then here is where the magic of the absolute comes into the play. People have an idea. And they have this idea, and they're thinking about this idea. And they're thinking about, how do we make a better light bulb, or how do we make a cheaper light bulb, or a more expensive light bulb? How do we make a light bulb that lasts longer? How do we make a computer that's lighter? How do we make a computer that's more compact and more serviceable with a larger memory? Only a few years ago, the computer memory was in kilobytes. And now it's in terabytes. Now it's so great. It's hard that we can't even imagine. The Library of Congress entire book list can be on a computer that we have today. It's amazing. It's amazing. But, okay, now, people have ideas, and they come up with these ideas. And so what do? They come up with the idea, well, how can we have tires that have no air in them and have them be, you know, serviceable on the road? Well, what is a tire? You go back to the basics for a tire. What does a scientist think a tire is? A tire is a wheel. A wheel. It's just a circular wheel. And how does a tire work? A tire works by holding something up and rolling it along on the road. So something that's heavy or whatever. Now, the tire is rolling. Now, where is most of the apparatus for the tire? It's up above the axle. The shock absorbers are up above the axle. All of the carriage for the car is up above the axle. Everything is. So now, it took them years to decide that rather than to have air in tires, they would have pneumatic axles, which they have had for a long time, but never so sophisticated as today. So scientists, kids coming out of school or not even in school, they have the idea, now how can we cause these axles to serve their purpose and yet not need air in the tires and not need any kind of tires that are going to be soft, that'll wear forever. They turn on any type of surface and they don't eat themselves up. How can we do this? Well, let's have another beer You know, let's play cards. Let's go working on our computer games. Let's go do all these silly things. And what happened? Bang! The idea strikes them. And they don't know it strikes them. But they wake up or they act and they say, I think that's an interesting idea. I say, how can I put it to work? So they say to their buddy, who is also in this wonderful magic of computer thinking, and they say, you know, if we did this, what would happen if we did that? And their buddy says, I don't know. I'm a programmer. I'll check it out for you. Or the other guy says, I don't know. I'm a mechanic. And I will put it together for you. I will take your idea and build a box for it. But the magic is there. The magic is in the mind of these people who have no reason to have the magic in their mind except they're open to it. Steve Jobs came up with many of his ideas, Wozniak was making the case for them and he was doing the software for them, and Steve just had the idea, now let's make it smaller, let's do this, let's do that, let's do the other thing. And Wozniak says, okay, whatever you want, I don't care. You give me the idea and I'll give it wings. And so the two of them worked together. Now, Jobs was just a young kid and he was not very diligent. He was like many of my students who I teach, I know that the divine in me knows the answer. Flippantly, I know the divine in me knows the answer. And flippantly, they come up with the answer because they're not fighting it. They're not pushing it. They're not worrying about it. They're not pressuring the answer to come. They're just flippantly using the principle and letting the answer be revealed to them. Now, can you do this? Can anyone do this? Is this something that can be done for anyone? Do we have to wait for the absolute to do it? It's out of the absolute. It's out of the allness. It's out of the isness. But we don't have to know about it. Do you know what your brain is? Do you know what your mind is? Do you know how you take hold of the universal knowledge and make use of it? No, not at all. You just take hold of it and use it, and you don't even think about it. You don't even give yourself a thought, how does it function? How does it happen? How does it take place? Now, if you had, you might have limited yourself or you might have unlimited yourself. It depends on whether you're opening a door inside of yourself with that knowledge or whether you're just grabbing an idea and running with it. Now, what's the idea that Steve Jobs had about his things, his computers and his programs, his iPods, iPads, iPhone, all those things, iMac, what have you? What was a pretty little box? Something that would intrigue everybody because they'd throw the kitchen sink in there. They'd put everything in there. And they would include all of the software with it when you buy it. You buy it and you get all the software with it so you can operate it. Well, the PCs were trying to do that too. And to a degree, they accomplished it. But they didn't have a pretty box. And so Apple sold its pretty boxes, but at first, it was having a tough time because there was a thought philosophy out, a strong thought philosophy out, saying Apple is no good. Apple is just a toy. Apple is not sophisticated. Apple is not professional like PCs. Apple is, you see, and this went around for a long time. And, of course, Steve Jobs didn't do much to change that attitude, but it went around for a long time. And then, little by little, Steve Jobs began falling in love with his new boxes, with his new toys, and his love began to spread to everyone else. And it's not that they needed those toys. It's not that they needed those things, but they had to have the latest iteration of what he was creating. He had to have the latest, whether they needed it or not. They had a computer, a PC computer in the old days, lasted for quite a number of years. But now the Apple, it'll last for many years too, but it's coming out with so many new parts, so many new apps, so many new possibilities to it. everyone has to have the latest. And it's not a matter that the other one won't do just fine, and it's not a matter that the other one couldn't be upgraded, because it can. But they want the new one. I think Apple made a mistake at one point. Apple iPhone 2 or 1 or 2, whatever it's called, was beautiful in touch, rounded edges, just so beautiful, just so wonderful, which they're now doing with their computers. But then they come out with the 3, and it has a squared edge, and the squared edge was its antenna, and it messed up everything. And so now they're coming out with 5, and it's coming out with a squared edge too. They would go back to the rounded edge. The rounded edge is a teddy bear. Mm-hmm. It's something you hold and you love and you snuggle. It's something that you delight in. And Ellen has a teddy bear, and she's not interested in giving it up, because it does everything she wants it to do, and it's a happy little machine, and it has no glitches in it. They've all been solved, and that's the wonderful thing. But you see, in the absolute, all the glitches don't exist, only solutions. But the glitches are there to cause people to go into their universal consciousness, to go into their absolute thinking and come up with ideas that are fantastic and beautiful and golden and wonderful. Our absolute consciousness is so glorious and so wonderful and so beautiful, if we would use it, if we would call upon it, if we would listen to it, if we would reveal what our absolute consciousness has to say, we would come up with some many exciting adventures that would just turn us on and make us into one. I have said, and others have said it also, I'm sure, the pharaohs could have had a beautiful Cadillac to drive around in. They did not need to go through the years of development. They didn't have to go through the years of cars and pneumatic tires and through pneumatic systems and shock absorbers. They didn't need to go through gasoline engines. They didn't need to go through all these various things. People are coming up with techniques that just put those things to shame, and they are not necessary. They're necessary because money has been invested in the manufacturing of these engines and the cars that are designed that way. And you'll notice that every year the car is almost exactly like it was last year, because it's too expensive to retool it into a more modern, a more beautiful way of looking at it. And it's silly, because that inhibits imagination. That inhibits growth. That inhibits the ideal of all. Now, Mercedes has always been known as the ideal car. It was handmade, and it was made very skillfully and very carefully, and there were no kickbacks on the Mercedes. They just made it beautifully and wonderfully. But then Mercedes started competing with the other cars. And when it started competing with the other cars, it started competing in their lackluster design, in their lackluster interior programming, and so forth. If Mercedes were to make itself an iPhone, make itself some teddy bear that people want, surely they don't need it, but they want it. If they would make it in that way and put a good price on it, people would buy it. Perhaps not so many at first, but after people saw how wonderful it is, just like the new Cadillac and many other of the higher-priced cars, you get in the car and you press a button, and the button has your name on it. The button says Ellen Jeremini, and then immediately the car moves to the position of Ellen's desire for sitting in a seat in the car. Immediately, the rear view mirrors and the forward mirrors and all the mirrors are adjusted to the ideal position for Ellen. Immediately, everything is in perfect order. And if she wants the little back arch on there, it'll be on there for her. Whatever she wants. Then the thermostat is set in the car to Ellen's temperature. Ellen wants 71 degrees. Herb wants 72 degrees and somebody else wants 80 degrees. Well, now, each person, if you're driving, you have the permission to do it. Or if you're sitting in the back seat, you can adjust your temperatures or you won't have them. Then Ellen gets in the car and the car radio goes on or music goes on because Ellen likes certain music. The car plays certain music for her. All of these things are done. You see, now, these are the teddy bear ideas. These are the iPhone ideas would make it a little cuddly toy, something so precious and so desirable. And there are people nowadays, when we were youngsters, a person who bought $1 million house was wealthy, really wealthy. Today, $1 million houses are a dime a dozen. People buy them all the time. Now, today, these executive cars, the Lincoln, the Cadillac, the Mercedes, and the Bentley, and Jaguar, and what have you, all of these cars are so absolutely fantastic, you know. And people are not at all adverse to paying whatever it costs. But unfortunately, some of these high-class cars are making run-of-the-mill cars because they want to get the money from the lower-priced purchases. And that's a foolish thing to do. Steve Jobs, while he was running Apple, never denigrated the Apple. The Apple was always the best. The Apple always had the finest program in it. The Apple always had the OS, the operating system, that was unique and special to it. It always had the number one operating system, and always it had an opportunity to upgrade the operating system. When Steve was running the show was always number one. And when he put on his yearly presentation to tell what new things were coming up, everyone instantly bought it by the millions. And it's unbelievable, but it's what they did. Now, why did they do that? Because he sold quality, and many other people were having difficulty, and they didn't want to. Dell had quality, but Dell sold as though it didn't have quality, and that made Dell not so good. And if we always, in our mind, could think that we are living quality, we are living of the absolute, the quality ideas. Now, there's nothing wrong with an inexpensive car. There's nothing wrong with a car that doesn't use so much gas. There's nothing wrong with any of these things. But the fact is that in the absolute concepts, right now, they're in the Library of Congress. They're already in the patent office. Our plans for cars that will go 200-300 miles on a gallon of gas. 200-300 miles. Now, why is it that they're not being promoted? Why is it they're not being developed? There are cars that can go on electricity, and they can go on small batteries, just like the batteries on our computers are getting smaller and smaller. Just like our iPad has 10 hours of life on it, 10 hours of life to run it. And only a year or two before, the smallest computer had to have maybe 2.5-3 hours of life on it, and that's all. Even some of our little tiny iPods, iPads, and stuff like that have greater battery life than ever. And that, those tiny little things, almost nothing in there. But it's amazing, because the absolute has all these possibilities, all these probabilities, all these opportunities, and it's up to us to come up with the geniuses that we have who will come up with them. Now, many of the children in Japanese schools are doing absolutely fantastic. They're doing absolutely fantastic. Their parents encourage them to learn, and the schools are encouraging them to learn, and they are brilliant. These Japanese children and Chinese children are absolutely brilliant. They are geniuses, but they have a problem. They have a big, big problem. they have Japanese and Chinese parents. Now, it's so sad that they have Japanese and Chinese parents. Well, the Japanese and Chinese parents say to their children, "You are genius. You can do this. You are with our family, with our name and our reputation. You can do this." They don't say you can do the little things. They say you can do the big things. They say you can do the impossible. And these Japanese and Chinese children go and do it because they know no different from home and school. Now, in America, we tell our children, "We're good, we teach you well, we give you a good education, but we do not inspire you by saying you're a genius. We do not inspire you by saying you're wonderful, you can do anything. There's nothing to it." We call it simple math, and this, we don't want to say simple math. We say ideal math. We say exciting math. We say math that can show us how to make batteries that are weighing 2 ounces and have a life of, say, 2 years. They got them. They got them. They send them aboard our space shuttles and so forth, and they are sending them out around the world, and they're going around and around for years and years and years and years and years, never ending, just wonderfully going on and on. But you see, this is the absolute performing in the mind and the body and the life of everyone. And the wonderful thing is that children who come out of these schools and who are learning on their computers and who are playing the games, I often was sort of reticent about games on computers because I thought they were too violent and they were too this or that or the other thing. And children don't see the violence. They see the rapidity on which the game is played. They see the speed at which the movement is made, that you have to hide from being shot and you have to do this and do that. And they don't get killed. Children who play cops and robbers, they never get killed. When they play cowboys and Indians, they never get killed. "Hey, you're dead, lay down." You know, and this is the attitude these people have playing those games. They don't get killed. And they're not doing something bad. They are using their creative genius to its maximum. They can do things that are absolutely fantastic. And though they are working on computers and doing work on computers that are not good, they're using a genius. And when that genius can be channeled into even more wonderful things, I think if we could train our young people to sort of search into the absolute, search into the allness, search into the improbable, impossible idea, and follow their genius, they would come up with possibilities that would shake our boats. And they are coming up with things. And there are major companies that these people have these ideas, and they take them to major companies, and the major companies buy them and then hide them because they don't want to have to put them out. They don't want to let them out. There are many, many companies that hold patents that allow gasoline engines to run on many miles per gallons, 25, 50, 100, 200, and more. Now, how can they do that? They do that by the simplicity of using techniques that we have not allowed ourselves to think about. When did they start thinking about having tires that were not pneumatic, that did not have air in them? When did they start thinking? Perhaps quite a while ago. Now, do you think the tire companies would encourage that kind of thing when they're making plenty of money? The tires won't wear out, the new ones. The new substance is going to be so resilient and made of plastic. It'll no longer need rubber. It'll no longer need all sorts of things that we presently need for these things. Who thought of the idea? How did they get it to be taken by the tire companies? How did the tire companies allow themselves to be talked into? They knew that if they didn't do it, somebody else was going to come up with it. And so they're going to be in the forefront of doing these new ideas and doing these new things. Well, you see, when you start thinking and you have a concept that comes to your mind and you say, I know that I know that I know, the divine in me knows the answer, then the divine in you begins to reveal it. Now, if you had been fortunate enough to have a Japper or Chinka as your mother or father, they would have taught you you're a genius. Now, do Americans' fathers and mothers teach their children that? Basically, no. Because of one reason. The Japanese and Chinese parents think that they are geniuses. They think they are magnificent people, magnificent geniuses, and bless their heart. And then they infuse this creativity, this imagination, this genius into their children. And they train them, having them go to school and showing them how to do it and backing up their education. How many American families back up the education of their children? Their children go and do it separate. How many go to the PTAs? How many go to the programs at the schools and the colleges? How many? Very few. And why do very few go to the colleges and the things with their people? Why? They don't go because they're too busy watching television. They're too busy watching pornographic materials. They're too busy sitting in the bar. They're too busy with their work, with their job that is rather mundane and rather ordinary. And yet, if any parent were to begin calling themselves a genius and realize each of their offspring are genius also, if they would believe this and know this, what magical things would come from our society? Well, now, happily, this does not have to be as drastic or as sad as it sounds, because throughout history, the genius mind has always come to the fore. It has been through great men and great women who showed that they were genius, who showed that they had great intelligence, who showed that they understood the sciences, they understood the literary things, they understood buildings, they understood all sorts of things that they shouldn't have understood because it was not common knowledge. But they understood it because they were listening to a greater knowledge within them called their absolute knowledge. And they didn't know, and the absolute is the genius, they didn't know that that's what it was. They didn't know. Now, why is it that a circus is called a lower valued organization where people who do things in a circus are just for amusement or just for amusement? Truly, if you stop and think of it, the people who work in circuses and who train as magicians, who train as riding, standing on horses, who train as doing all the things that the clowns do and how they can do different things. They learn how to fall and ride. They learn how to do. How do they learn how? That's magic. That's magic. Those are geniuses. They are taking an intelligence. They're not saying it can't be done. They're merely saying, poof, if he can do it, I can do it. If they can stand 5, 6, 10 people high on each other's shoulder and walk up and down each other, and the bottom man stands there, and he's not any gargantua, he's just a healthy, strong person. But there's a technique to it. There is a manner of it. There's a balance to it. There's all the things that go into it. And this is the magic. This is the magic that people who are geniuses do it. And I would say, probably, all of the people working for a circus, no matter what area, are geniuses. They all are fantastic. They do things that boggle the mind. They do things that inspire oohs and ahs. They do things that make people think, wow, how beautiful. And can you imagine yourself? And I don't think you can. But can you imagine yourself stocking-footed or nothing on your feet, walking on a tightrope, on a cable that's put from here to there, and just keep your balance and walk and make it appear that you're not having your balance all the time, a little jiggling and stuff like that, you know, to give the crowd a thrill, but to walk from a building to another building and without a net beneath you. Now, there are some who fall and die, but the majority don't. Because if the majority did, that would not be an attractive program to do. But what are they doing? What are they doing? They're recognizing, hey, I can do this. The divine in me shows me how. My mother did it. My father did it. My brothers all do it. You know, we're the tight-roping Murphys, you know, and we're wonderful. So what is it all about, and how does it work? How does it function? How do we reach into that invisible genius, that invisible knowledge and awareness that's within us, our absolute self, our allness that we are? How can we reach in there and draw upon that and use it for our everyday experience? How can we do that? How can we take a poker, blazing fire poker, and stick it in our mouth, down our throat, and bring it out? I mean, and obviously the guy isn't dead. He's not killing himself. There's some technique to it. But fire is fire. You know, you put that close to your face and your mouth and stuff like that. Amazing. Now, how do they do it? How many people have stopped to think how they do it? Not too many. But it is the act of a genius. It's the act of some magical attitude that allows them to do that. Now, how can they do that? They are in tune with their divine inner self. Now, Wozniak was associated with Steve Jobs, and Steve was a tough bird, but he had imagination. He had dreams. He went to Disney and worked on their program for quite a while, made billions while doing it because he came up with beautiful ideas. He's not given too much credit for that because he's done the computer bit with the Apple program. Well, what's he doing? He came up with this magic, and he worked with his friend, Wozniak, as a friend right next to him, showing him what he was doing, showing him how he was thinking, showing him the way he was thinking. But why didn't Wozniak come up with the same way? Why did he come up as a backdoor Johnny instead of a front door Johnny? Why didn't he come up with those ideas beautifully and wonderfully and powerfully in his mind? Because he did not believe that he was a genius. And to be sure, he is a genius. He is a genius. The fact is, many of the men who worked on Apple and who didn't get bonuses at the time they should have gotten them, when he got the money from Apple, he gave those bonuses to these guys he felt he should have gotten it. Money didn't mean anything to him. Ideas, nothing meant. It was merely carrying out somebody else's dream, somebody else's proposal, somebody else's idea, and he did it beautifully and great. Now, many of us are like that. We are associated with beautiful people who are extremely brilliant, just like alias Geremini, a magical man with money. He was a magical person. Everything he touched turned into money. He did it beautifully, but he never did it so much for himself as he did it for others. He made his magic work for other people. He made his magic work for the business and things like that. Now, why didn't he do it for himself? Well, he was like Wozniak. He didn't believe that he was a genius. He was. And he acted like a genius, and he expressed himself like a genius, but he didn't believe it. Now, until you and I believe that we're a genius, we will not touch home base with absolute principles, because we'll always let somebody else be the way shower. Always let somebody else show us how to do things, and we will lose the opportunity to be the magic person that we are. We'll lose the opportunity to walk on the tightrope or to make the iPhone. we lose the opportunity. Not that we don't know how, but we don't do it because we don't believe that we're a genius. So I suggest to you today, and to me, that we say, I am a genius. I am open and receptive to the infinite wisdom of the cosmos. I am one as the absolute, absolute, absolute. And I am that now. And how wonderful it is.